Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Here and now. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the White House overstepped its authority when it set up special military tribunals shortly after the 9/11 attacks to try those considered enemy combatants. The High Court found the tribunals are illegal under the Military Code of Justice and the Geneva Conventions. This morning, President Bush spoke about the ruling and the future of the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
I want to find a way forward. In other words, I have told the people that I would like for there to be a way to return people from Guantanamo to their home countries, but some of them, people need to be tried in our courts. And that's the Hamden decision was the way forward for that part of my statement. And again, I would like to review the case, and we are. We got people looking at it right now to determine how we can work with Congress, if that's available, to solve the problem.
The case focused on Salem Ahmed Hamdan, who allegedly worked as a driver for Osama bin Laden. Hamdan has spent 4 years at Guantanamo Bay, where the tribunals were to be held, and he faces a single count of conspiring against U.S. citizens. Only 10 of the estimated 450 detainees now at Guantanamo have been charged with crimes. Joining us on the line is Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston. And Lyle, when you read today's ruling, what are some of the key words in the majority opinion and in the dissent that stand out here?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that the court is very skeptical of a president who acts at a time, in fact, that the court regards not an emergency situation, without consulting Congress. Justice Breyer wrote a very brief, for the Supreme Court, separate opinion in which he undertook to say that all that we're doing today is to say that the president has not been given a blank check by Congress to act. So it's clear that what the court is saying between the lines and sometimes in the lines themselves is that as this president wages the war on terrorism, it would be a good idea for him and would be good for the democratic society that we have if he were to do so more in consultation with Congress. So this is in that respect, this opinion goes well beyond the legal and factual details of it as a kind of a civics lesson for President Bush about how to conduct the powers of wartime.
Mm-hmm. What about Geneva Conventions? Where does that fit into this ruling?
Well, the president has insisted that the Geneva Convention simply does not apply to people who are taken captive during the war on terrorism. The court does not finally resolve that issue today because they conclude that at least one part of the Geneva Convention has been violated by the way the president created these commissions, so that the Geneva Convention is brought to bear against President Bush, at least in determining whether or not it gave him the authority to set up these war crimes tribunals. The court also makes clear, by the way, that Congress, in passing the 9/11 resolution after the terrorist attacks, did not, in that act, give the president the authority that he's claiming to have in setting up these commissions.
Veteran Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston writes for SCOTUSblog.com. Thanks very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks.
For some legal analysis of today's high court ruling, we turn first to Jonathan Turley. He's a law professor at George Washington University. And Jonathan, are you surprised by the ruling?
No, I'm not surprised because many of us have been arguing for years that the president lacked this authority. You know, this was a pretty considerable claim of authority. He was claiming the right to create his own legal system just on the other side of our borders and to try these individuals according to rules that he wrote or his subordinates wrote, rules that could lead to the death penalty for many of these individuals. Now, all of that ran against the constitutional grain. And I think what the Supreme Court is saying here is that ultimately this remains a nation of shared authority. And there's no room in that system for an absolute ruler. You can't become a government onto yourself. And so he's going to have to come up now with a new policy to handle these individuals.
Hmm. And what do you think it means for the future of the individuals at Guantanamo? Can they be indefinitely held now? Do they have trials? I mean, do we know, or is it just up to the White House now to come up with Plan B?
Well, of course, that's the magic question. You know, in some ways, the president wants to close Guantanamo Bay, although he notably has not said that he regretted the policies that led to Guantanamo Bay becoming such a symbol of abuse. He just wants to get rid of the symbol. And so there's a danger that he could create 100 small Guantanamo Bays by shipping these individuals to foreign prisons. The other option is to go to the military court system and seek congressional authority. But the reason this decision is so important is that it's occurring in the middle of a constitutional crisis. This president is accused in a host of different areas of violating the separation of powers, assuming absolute authority in the name of national security. And here you've got the Supreme Court once again pushing back and saying, you have to get the authority to act. And it's as fundamental a question as you can face in the Constitution. But the other thing I think that's going to raise a lot of objections is that we've now wasted years. You know, many of us believe that it was perfectly clear that he did not have this authority years ago. And so we've now not only wasted years, we're not only back where we started, but it has cost us a huge amount in terms of credibility and legitimacy. We went from being viewed as the victim of 9/11 to a rogue nation, largely because of these tribunals, because of the way these rules were written and how these prisoners were treated. And so that's a considerable cost, and now we have nothing to show for it.
Does this ruling today from the Supreme Court do anything about the classification of the detainees at Guantanamo?
It does very little. I mean, it focuses primarily on the president's lack of authority, and it leaves still much to be determined. But what it clearly indicates is that the administration is going to have to go to Congress and come up with a different approach that complies with authority given to it. And that puts them back to where they were. And what the great mystery, frankly, for me is why they've done this. You know, I talked to administration officials after 9/11, and I told them, you know, as many of us did, you know, you don't have this authority, and you're going to lose ultimately. And what will you have to show for it? And I think that this was a grossly stupid act to try these military tribunals. If they had simply complied with the rule of law years ago, these guys could have been tried. Many of them deserve to be punished. And they could be sitting in jails right now having been tried and convicted. But now, there's a real question of how they will do that. One of the reasons the administration wanted these tribunals is because the tribunals did not comply with basic legal protections, like the authentication of evidence. Well, they needed that because they had violated the rights of these individuals according to domestic and international law. So now, if they try to try them, it's going to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm. And tried and convicted how, I guess, is the question, right? What can
That's
we
right.
do now? Right.
That's right. And, you know, I guess I will go to my grave wondering why the administration took this path. And I think the reason is that there are people in the administration from before 9/11 that wanted to reinvent the office of the presidency, to make this absolute type of ruler. And Dick Cheney admitted that recently and said that they, when they went to office, they wanted to change what the presidency was. And so you had all these individuals that saw 9/11 as a way of getting recognition of a president's unchecked authority.
Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's my great pleasure.
Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington University. Joining us now is Douglas Kimmeck. He's a professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University in California, and he's former legal counsel to Presidents Reagan and George Bush Sr. And Douglas, strong words from Professor Turley here. What's your reaction to today's Supreme Court ruling?
Well, it's a disappointment, and I don't think there's any mystery as to why the president sought to create military tribunals. He pursued that course because we were attacked. and we were attacked not by a signatory nation to the Geneva Convention. We weren't attacked by France or Britain or Japan. We were attacked by something called Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is the very definition of an unlawful combatant. They target civilian populations. They do not observe the laws of war. They fight out of uniform. They are the pirates of our age, and they are very dangerous. And the president quite rightly concluded, based upon the experience of Abraham Lincoln with military commissions, the experience of Woodrow Wilson with military commissions, the experience of Franklin Roosevelt with military commissions, that it was appropriate to both detain these enemy combatants when we captured them, and to the extent that our interrogations indicated that they had violated the laws of war, that we would try them appropriately, consistent with the manner in which enemy combatants of this type had been treated in the past. So I don't really think there is a mystery. I do think the president had that authority by virtue of his power as commander-in-chief. And what the court said today is that they largely skipped over any meaningful discussion of the president's foreign affairs authority and instead said that he was entirely limited by Congress's specifications in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Now, the Uniform Code of Military Justice is an excellent piece of legislation. It's designed to apply to honorable men and women who serve in uniform, whether they be our own soldiers or those who oppose us on terms that comply with the law of war. But they really had no application to unlawful combatants. And it's a disappointment that the court didn't see that.
I guess the big question is, what should be the strategy from here now? The president has said he wants to find a way to move forward. He wants to see if perhaps some of these detainees could go back to their home countries. He's also said he wants to close Guantanamo. What do you think is the best option for the administration here?
Well, I do think the opinion is largely a statutory opinion. It is not denying the president's constitutional authority because, as I said a moment ago, it doesn't discuss it. So I think the president can go to Congress and say, look, the court has said I'm not statutorily authorized to try these individuals in the manner in which I've described. I seek your authorization. Now, in an election year and in a partisan environment, the chances of having that go smoothly seem to me to be long. But the president clearly has that possibility, and I'm certain his lawyers this morning are going through the details of what would be required. But Congress could authorize exactly what he did. They could authorize it specifically. Again, in my judgment, reading the statutes that already exist, I think Congress had impliedly authorized what the president did, and he could get that explicit authorization. There is an alternative.
Briefly.
The president could consider a ad hoc international tribunal such as we had convened through the UN Security Council for the former Yugoslavia.
Okay, we're out of time. Douglas Kamek joining us from the studios at Pepperdine University in California, where he's a law professor. He's also former legal counsel to President Reagan and former President Bush. Thank you, Douglas. There's more coming up here and now. Here and now, we're continuing our coverage of today's landmark Supreme Court decision striking down President Bush's special war crimes tribunals for terror suspects at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We want to look at what this decision could mean strategically for what the president calls the global war on terror. Joining us on the line is Eugene Fidel. He's president of the National Institute of Military Justice. He was the attorney for James Yee, the Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo, who was once accused of being a spy. Charges against Yee were eventually dropped. Welcome, Gene.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. Can you remind us of the differences between these special tribunals that were struck down by the High Court today and regular courts martial?
Right. There are a number of differences. Probably the chief one is that courts martial are governed by the normal rules of evidence, what we call the strict rules of evidence, the usual prohibition, for example, on hearsay evidence in normal circumstances, they have basically the same rules of evidence that you would find in federal district court or in the local state courts. That's an important difference because the military commissions don't insist on the strict rules of evidence. Another important difference is that there are occasions when the accused, the defendant, can be excluded from the trial and evidence can be admitted that the defendant never gets to see. So those are some really, really serious problems.
So do you think that these detainees then should face trials?
Well, some of them may well merit trial. I think that there are forums that are available to try them. My own suggestion, if the administration were to ask me, is they should try anyone they need to try in federal district court. After all, Congress passed the Patriot Act, which has a variety of very broad prohibitions in it. It's been used before to prosecute terrorists. And in my opinion, any case that can be prosecuted in federal court ought to be prosecuted in federal court. Only as a fallback would I recommend using a court-martial. And if it turned out that the only place you could prosecute some of these people was in a court-martial, I wouldn't lose any sleep over that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Gene, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's my privilege.
Gene Fidel is president of the National Institute of Military Justice. Well, Rul Ahmed knows what it's like to be held at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. He's a British Muslim who was captured in Afghanistan and sent to the Guantanamo Bay Detention Facility. He was never charged with any crime, and he was released after 2 years. He joins us on the line from the UK. And Rul, your reaction to the Supreme Court ruling?
I think it's a victory for all the detainees in Guantanamo, including myself and my friends, because the military tribunals were against human rights, against the Geneva Convention, against the American Constitution. It's nice to know that the judge has ruled against what is illegal and what Bush has been preaching to his people.
But this decision doesn't affect Guantanamo directly as to whether it will close. And the president of the White House has said it may not be possible to send some of the detainees there back home because they could be in danger in their home countries.
At least it shows that, you know, they can't take people to these military tribunals, which were illegal in the first place. So that's one good news. And secondly, about President Bush could say that they cannot send certain detainees back to the home countries. I think if these people are innocent and can't be sent back to their country, then America is responsible for their detention. Why doesn't Bush give these detainees American citizenships and give them place to stay in their own country?
Rul Ahmed, he was held at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Facility for 2 years before he was released. He and his two friends who were held there are now the subjects of a new film called The Road to Guantanamo. Thanks for speaking with us, Rul. And joining us from the naval base at Guantanamo Bay is Carol Rosenberg, who's been covering this story for the Miami Herald for the past 4.5 years. And Carol, give us a quick view from there. Any reaction from U.S. authorities?
I have to tell you, there's no immediate meaningful impact down here today. The commission chambers were already dark by Pentagon order after the three detainees committed suicide. And the admiral has said that interrogations and detention operations would continue whether or not there's a war card. It doesn't mean that they're closing this prison by any means, this decision.
Do the prisoners know anything about today's ruling?
I don't think they know yet. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of attorneys meeting with prisoners over there, but for example, Salim Hamdan, the Yemeni fellow who brought this challenge through his Navy lawyer all the way to the Supreme Court, there's no way he can know right now. Unless his guards tell him, and I don't think they're going to be doing that. His lawyer's up at the Supreme Court, and he's down here, and I think they're going to have to wait until his lawyer gets down here and notify him.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the suicides at Guantanamo Bay, and recently you wrote that some prisoners continue to plot suicide attempts there, hoarding drugs in a prosthetic limb, for example. Will this ruling today, if the prisoners ever do find out about it, do you think that it will affect the mood there and maybe prompt more folks to try to make suicide attempts, because it looks like we're starting from square one again?
Look, only 10 of these 450 guys here were up for these military commissions anyways, so it will be really hard to read their reactions on this. If they're despairing that they have no legal process, And that's why they're trying to kill themselves, as the lawyers say, because it's despair. One would think this would heighten the despair. There's no legal process. If you believe that the military running these camps, that these are these diehard anti-American jihadists, you'd think maybe they'd be happy by this decision, because it looks like President Bush got it handed to him by the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. At this point, though, no sign of anything really happening there, and no sign that there's going to be any steps to try to close Guantanamo Bay.
The admiral has been very, very specific. He has said that whatever the Supreme Court rules, they're going to continue detaining these people, that one has nothing to do with the other. And, you know, they're plowing ahead right now with plans to open a new 200-prisoner, $30 million prison building here called Camp 6. And it's a long-term permanent facility being built on a Pentagon contract. It should open in August.
Do you ever see any of the detainees, Carol?
We see them. I've seen them coming and going. I actually saw a hearing yesterday where one of the Afghani captives here argued that he should be sent home. It was all a misunderstanding, that the allegations the Americans have against him are not founded. It's sort of like a parole board, but mostly we don't get to talk. Well, we never get to talk to them, and mostly we don't get to hear them speak. They're behind the razor wire, only talking to interrogators, guards.
Carol, thank you very much. We got to go. Sorry. Carol Rosenberg joining us from the naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
Here and Now. There's increasing tension in the Middle East today. Israeli troops have rounded up more than 60 members of the Palestinian ruling party Hamas as they push forward into Gaza, pressuring Hamas to release a kidnapped Israeli soldier. One of the groups responsible for the kidnapping said in response it killed an 18-year-old Jewish settler. All of this is prompting the question as to whether the region is getting closer to an all-out war. Well, joining us on the line from Gaza City is Boston Globe correspondent Ann Barnard. And Ann, we spoke with you Tuesday when Hamas was insisting that Israel release hundreds of prisoners in exchange for the freedom of kidnapped soldier Gilad Shalit, and Israel was refusing to negotiate. What do these latest moves suggest?
Well, Israel obviously is taking a tough line. Israel has always been very sensitive to prisoners being held in captivity, and they've alternated in the past between very tough attempts to rescue prisoners that have sometimes ended with the prisoners dead, and on the other hand, they've sometimes traded other Palestinian prisoners for their own prisoners, or even for the bodies of slain captives. When the body of a settler who was kidnapped in the West Bank in recent days was found today, they arrested even more Hamas members, both ministers and members of the legislature.
And what does Israel intend to do with these Hamas members?
Israel has said all along that they will not negotiate and that they are going to continue pressing militarily into the Gaza Strip and to continue to politically isolate the government led by Hamas.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't seem like they're going in the direction of a prisoner exchange when they've arrested political leaders en masse. Hamas, of course, objects to this and says this is a democratically elected government. The government had nothing to do with the kidnapping. And that's, of course, the crux of the debate and the conflict between them and Israel.
Right. There are other activities happening in Gaza right now as well. Can you explain that a little bit, Ann?
Well, the Israelis have dropped leaflets warning people that Israelis will be entering the Gaza Strip and that they should not interfere with their operations. They should obey them. They should stay out of the way. Hmm. The other thing that is dominating people's minds here in the Gaza Strip today is that Israel has bombed a power station that supplies electricity to more than half of the Gaza Strip. And what it means is not only are people without electricity, more than 50% are without water, because most of the water in the Gaza Strip is pumped from underground wells that require electricity. They're worried about an outbreak of cholera or other waterborne diseases.
It's sounding increasingly as if the area is moving toward war.
Well, that's what everyone here is afraid of. They say, we will not give in, we will not leave our homes. They don't really have a choice because Israel isn't letting anyone in or out of the Gaza Strip.
Are people fearful right now, Ann?
People on the street are a mix of fearful and defiant.
And Israel, of course, is saying that they are just taking steps against a terrorist organization here, and this is a campaign against terrorism.
Yes, Prime Minister Olmert said yesterday that the purpose is not to punish the Palestinian people. It's to unconditionally demand and achieve the release of captured soldiers. Palestinians don't feel that there was any reason to bomb the power station other than to make their lives difficult and pressure them to make demands on their government to free the soldier.
Right, Anne, thanks very much for speaking with us. Boston Globe correspondent Anne Barnard, who joined us on the line from Gaza. Thank you, Anne. For some analysis now, we turn to Rami Khoury. He's editor of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon. And Rami, it was looking as if relations between Israel and the Palestinians were maybe not improving, really, but at least stable. This kidnapping and this bombing of the power station in Gaza, what does this suggest?
It suggests that for both the Palestinians and the Israelis, unilateral actions and military actions are not going to solve the basic Arab-Israeli or Palestinian-Israeli problem. The Israelis and many people in the U.S. and the West thought that the Israeli pullout from Gaza was going to be a trigger that would set off wider peace negotiations. In fact, that hasn't worked, and the reason is that the basic problem in this conflict is not just pieces of occupied land, but the ability of the Palestinians and the Israelis both to live in peace and full national integrity, security, and normal life. That hasn't happened for the Palestinians after the Israeli pullout. The conflict continues, and it's represented by the Israelis continuing to attack Gaza and the Palestinians continuing to send rockets into Israel. So I think the lesson is that militarism and unilateral actions won't solve the problem.
Is peace not even a possibility in your mind?
No, I think it is a possibility, and it always has been, but it's always required something which we haven't had yet, which is the Israelis and the Palestinians simultaneously saying that, first of all, they both have equal rights. This is not a situation where you can say, well, the Israelis will put out a little bit, and then if the Palestinians behave, maybe the Palestinians will get their rights and the Israelis pull out a little bit more. That won't work. They've got to say simultaneously they are both national communities that have equal rights before each other, before the law, and before God.
But in this particular instance, in this particular case here, now that we have this kidnapping of the Israeli soldier, the rounding up of the Hamas members, and the bombing of the power station in Gaza, it's looking, at least from the outside anyway, increasingly like war. Do you think that that's the case?
It is a kind of low-intensity war that's been continuous. I mean, this hasn't stopped. The Israelis have killed dozens and dozens of Palestinians in the last month by attacking Gaza, and the Palestinians have fired rockets and killed Israelis and kidnapped one soldier, killed another settler the other day. So this is a war that's ongoing. And there's fears now. People are worried about, well, will the Syrians or Hezbollah be drawn in? And the Syrians said that the Israelis sent airplanes over the Syrian territory yesterday. And so there's always these concerns about a regional expansion of the conflict. I personally don't think that's going to happen.
To many of us, it also seems, though, that a lot of this may have to do with fighting and infighting in Hamas. How much of a role is that playing in all of this?
It is an element, and you have two simultaneous processes going on within Palestinian society. There are several trends within Hamas, and they're working out exactly what is the dominant common policy. And at the same time, you have a conflict between Hamas, which now heads the government, and the president, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, who heads the Fatah group, which has run Palestinian society for about the last 35, 40 years. And they're in conflict with one another as well. So there are issues to be resolved within the Palestinian political community. But they are really quite secondary in many ways to these more overriding issues between Palestinians and Israelis, which have gone on really since the 1967. So I think this is a moment for both sides, both people and leadership, to think more profoundly and honestly about whether military action really brings you what you want, or does it just make the other side more determined to fight on? And then what are the core issues that need to be resolved to solve this politically, because in the end, this is a political dispute. It's not just an issue of a piece of occupied land or somebody who was killed or abducted. It's a political dispute about the rights of people to live in a normal society, and both of them have to enjoy those rights in Israel and among the Palestinians simultaneously. You cannot have one party having more rights than the other.
Thanks very much for speaking with us, Rami Khoury, editor of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Here and Now. At least 13 people are dead as a result of rising floodwaters across the mid-Atlantic United States. In Pennsylvania, rescue helicopters plucked residents from rooftops as they tried to flee swollen rivers and creeks. Dikes and levees near Wilkes-Barre are holding as the river there crested below the expected level. In New York, two truckers died when they drove their rigs into a flooded creek that cut across an interstate highway. An entire house was seen floating down the Susquehanna River near Binghamton, New York. There's also flooding on the Delaware River, and that's where we turn now. Eugene Son is a reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia, and he joins us from Trenton, New Jersey. Eugene, thanks for being with us.
No problem.
Give us a sense of where we're talking about on the Delaware River specifically.
Well, I'm looking at the island section of Trenton. It's a neighborhood that's between Route 29, one of the main highways around here, and the river. And I'm looking down one of the streets right now, and it looks more like Venice than it does look like Trenton. The streets are completely covered, and the difference is, you know, some houses, the water is up to the front step, some is above the front step, and some it's just in the basement. And we're looking at the river cresting sometime this afternoon.
And how far above flood stage would that be?
It's expected to be somewhere between 5 and 6 feet above flood stage, but that's about 25 or 26 feet higher than it normally is.
So are people evacuating? What's happening? Are there shelters set up?
Yeah, about 2,000 people evacuated from this neighborhood area. There are shelters set up, although the vast majority of people I spoke to are staying with friends and family. And there are some sporadic smaller evacuations in other river towns along the Delaware on Pennsylvania side and on the New Jersey side.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's been flooding in Trenton before, correct?
This is the third significant flood in the last 2 years since the fall of 2004. And that is not lost on anybody, and particularly the residents of the island section. More than a few people I spoke to today said, you know, three strikes, you're out. I'm moving out after all this.
Right. It would seem that they should be able to figure out some way to try to help at this point, take some preventative measures. I know the governor there has declared a state of emergency for the entire state of New Jersey. Is that affecting state government, businesses? What's happening on that end?
Well, the biggest effect that's having is that it's allowed him to tell state employees who work in areas of Trenton that are either tangentially or directly affected to stay home, or also just they're trying to minimize the load on utilities and the water system by keeping people out of the city. The water filtration plant for the city had to go offline because of the flooding and all the muck in the water, and so they were running off a reservoir, and one of the major things they can do to slow the water consumption as the city is keep a lot of state employees home for the day.
Mm-hmm. What about south of Trenton, New Jersey? Explain to me exactly where the river goes from there. Is it going to get worse in those areas?
Not as much. It generally gets wider south of Trenton. It flows from here to places like Bordentown and Bristol and further down to Philadelphia and Camden, New Jersey. And it generally gets wider as it goes further south. So typically, while there will be some flooding downstream, it generally kind of the peak of it and the worst of it hits somewhere around here.
Mm-hmm. And we've heard that it seems to be improving somewhat in Pennsylvania.
The waters seem to be doing better. I think the meteorologists and the scientists who predict where the floods will stop and recede are saying that it's not looking quite as bad as they had worried, but it's still, no solace to all the people who've been evacuated and people who, for the third time in 2 years, are talking about replacing their furnaces and water heaters and lots of their belongings.
Mm-hmm. How does this flooding compare with the other flooding in Trenton?
It's about the same. I mean, it's certainly to the point where there was no question people had to leave this neighborhood. It was not a matter of, oh, they're just being alarmist. And that's actually, I think, the one thing that's different here is that people, the more they've gone through this, the more than likely they are to heed an evacuation call the first time they're told, rather than having to be rousted by the police.
Right. So just briefly, Eugene, any more rain in the forecast?
Well, right now the sun just came out, and it seems like the weather forecasters tell me that no significant rains are in the forecast. They're saying it's possible there could be some passing showers, but nothing significant.
All right, well, stay dry. Eugene Sun is a reporter for WHYY, speaking with us from Trenton, New Jersey, about the flooding there. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Mm-hmm.
Many people probably dream about getting away from it all on an island in the South Pacific, while others actually do it, and still others, J. Martin Troost, for example, do it more than once. Troost's first book, The Sex Lives of Cannibals, was about living on the island of Tarawa, where getting away from it all meant dealing with vicious dogs and neighbors who carried machetes. He tried getting away from that with a brief stint at a World Bank job and possible career in Washington, D.C. But the urge to wander came on Martin again. He and his wife Sylvia moved to the South Pacific island of Vanuatu, which some might remember from the reality show Survivor, where there were reported cannibals and some frighteningly ugly centipedes.
A Vanuatu centipede is, to begin with, a carnivore. Yes, that's right. Vanuatu centipedes eat meat. Now, I'm no entomologist, but you'd think that fact alone would be enough to bump it out of the insect classification. Second, they are venomous. They kill their prey by injecting it with venom, and have two pincers near their head designed for this very purpose. And then there's this. Their legs are venomous, too. Centipedes can have upwards of 300 legs. Ponder that, if you will. Now, 300 legs, of course, need to be connected to something, something large enough to carry 300 legs. You might conclude then, and rightly so, that Vanuatu centipedes are big, very big. They can grow to be more than a foot long, and they are nearly indestructible.
That's J. Martin Troost reading from his new book, Getting Stoned with Savages, a trip through the islands of Fiji and Vanuatu. And Martin Troost joins us on the line. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You like provocative book titles?
It takes a lot of work to find a title that manages to be offensive to both the left and the right. you make a little joke and suddenly, you know, it's on a book cover.
Right.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do with, you know, when your first book is called The Sex Lives of Cannibals? Where else can you go?
Right, like, right.
Getting stoned with savages.
Well, after 2 years on one island, you decided that life there wasn't so great. I think at one point you called it the worst place in the world. And tried the 9-to-5 thing for a while in Washington, but then you wanted to go away again. Why?
The 9-to-5 thing in Washington has a way of sort of putting things in perspective again, and suddenly island life looks pretty darn good.
And you originally...
Plus, my wife had a good job, and so I could just follow her and hang out.
You originally were going to go to Fiji, yes, but then it was the political
there
situation.
Was a coup.
Right.
Right.
And then you ended up in Vanuatu.
That's right.
A place that has a reputation for cannibalism.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The last officially recorded instance of cannibalism was in 1969. And I thought since then there might be some off-the-books cannibalism going on, too.
And when you were in Vanuatu, you had several adventures. You discovered the drug kava. Can you explain that to people who don't know what it is?
Kava is this narcotic mud water. It derives from a pepper plant that grows throughout much of the Pacific. It's imbibed throughout much of Melanesia and Polynesia. And I had known that before, but Vanuatu kava is unique for its strength. It's sort of like the heroin of the kava world, if you will. And kava is sort of drunk traditionally throughout the islands, but in Vanuatu, given that it's particularly strong, around sunset every evening, the entire male population of Vanuatu is sedate, shall we say. And my theory is that when you look at Melanesia, you look at the anarchy in Papua New Guinea, you look at civil war in the Solomon Islands, you look at the coups in Fiji, and there's many, many problems in Vanuatu, and yet nothing ever changes. And I think it's because of the kava.
Well, you also write about some unique experiences that you had in the tropics. You visited an active volcano. You tried to locate some of the cannibals on Vanuatu. And why do you think you wanted to take risks like that?
Well, once you're there, and you might as well live it. You know, if there happens to be a volcano within, you know, that's accessible, well, at a certain point, why not go take a look at the volcano? Same with cannibalism. I mean, it's such a, I regard it an intriguing habit, shall we say, that I thought, you know, might need a little more investigating.
What did you find out?
I found out how the man was imbibed. I was taken up into this long, long, hard hike to an old cannibal village at the top of the mountain. And there the chief explained to me how, what they did with the man. When they found someone from an enemy tribe, they'd be taken back to the village, given kava, made to dance, and then they'd be clubbed to death, chopped into little pieces, and then, you know, if you want me to get into the details.
No, that's fine. You can stop right there. Thank you. And in terms of finding maybe the last recorded reference was in 1969, right, of cannibalism
right.
occurring in the islands, did you find any sort of evidence that this may be sort of an attractive thing for people.
Rumors, suggestions, but ones that seem to have, at least for those that are spreading the rumors, quite a bit of credibility. I think these days, if it does occur, it's more for black magic reasons, because black magic is very powerful influence still on the islands. Whereas before Westerners arrived, it was actually for a food source. As the chief explained to me, he said in former times there were many men, but not much meat. And so, there you have it.
Okay. And then further along in your story, your wife, Sylvia, becomes pregnant.
Yep.
And you decide, this is all very nice, Vanuatu, but maybe not the place to have children.
No, it's, as I said, you know, my wife was interested in having as many third world experiences as she could, but childbirth wasn't one of them.
But then to Fiji, is Fiji much better? There's still political unrest in Fiji, which is why you didn't go initially. So is it much better in Fiji?
Well, there was a new private hospital. In the Pacific, those who can afford it, they tend to travel to New Zealand and Australia to receive more advanced medical care. As this was Fiji's effort to lure those people who would otherwise go to Australia and New Zealand to come to Fiji.
You write about how really your son, Lucas, was very much loved in Fiji, and the children were adored, and there was this village, really, maybe adopted village, to help care for him a little bit. But that didn't necessarily entice you to want to stay in Fiji. I think maybe to a lot of folks here, where raising children may be a little bit more isolated, particularly those folks who aren't near their extended families, it might have sounded very idyllic.
It was idyllic in a way, because in a place like Fiji, you haven't really satisfied your function as a member of a community until you've started breeding and having children of your own. They value children there, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to be around. But for us personally, of course, we're on Fiji, which is far, far away from our known world, so to speak, where our friends and family and that sort of thing are. And the other thing is it's the islands, of course, you know, the mosquito bites, you know, does it become dengue, does it become malaria, does it become, when you have these sorts of worries and you have a little infant.
But wasn't there more there as well behind your decision to leave, that you decide really against the life of some of the expatriates that you had seen living in the tropics for quite some time?
Yes, they become lost. They have one foot in one world, one foot in another world, and they don't belong to either. You're never going to be sort of taken in completely as of the islands. And, you know, you don't want to raise your child as a perpetual stranger to his geography.
I wonder now, is the wanderlust out of your system, or do you think you may get tired of California and where you are now and maybe decide that another travel adventure is in the offing?
It's funny. We've already sold our house right now, and I'm on a book tour now, and everywhere I go, could I live here? Could I live here?
So it's always there.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'm just, you know, my wife and I are just hardwired to make a change every 2 years. But now that we have a second child as well, we have sort of this internal pressure to create a home. And, you know, that sense of home, in a way, I envy those who arrive at a place and know that this is where they're going to settle for the rest of their lives. But I think for others, the idea, you know, the sense of home, it just sort of catches up to them from behind. You stay put for long enough and it becomes home. We're still trying to find that place.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
J. Martin Troost is the author of Getting Stoned with Savages, A Trip Through the Islands of Fiji and Vanuatu. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time.